DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's Worldlink, bringing you the personal stories from behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andy Valver. 2013 is upon us, and what better way to start the new year than with a laugh?
The most taboo topic is not being funny. That's the only taboo a comedian should have. Not being funny is the greatest taboo.
More from German comedian Max Stettenbauer later, as well as American satirist Will Durst and a motley crew of Russian agitators going under the name of Vojna. That's all coming up on Worldlink. You are listening to Worldlink, where I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andy Valver.
Welcome to the show, Andy. Now, I believe that there's a reason that you are my co-host for this New Year's Worldlink special. You are a comedian.
I am indeed a comedian, and it is a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Go on, set out your comedian credentials for us.
Well, I was lucky to come up in the 80s in San Francisco at the legendary comedy clubs like the Holy City Zoo, the other Cafe, Cobb's, with people like Will Durst, Ellen DeGeneres, Dana Carvey,
Rob Schneider. Stop the name dropping. Come on, get on with the story.
And from there, I spent some time in L.A., and then I was in New York at the Improv and Catch a Rising Star. And it was a really fun time to be a comic in America back then. I've been working sort of ever since.
Were you scared the first time you got up and did stand-up? You were quite young, right? You're a teenager.
Oh, well, not quite a teenager, but I was, yes. Well, you know, I went to open mic nights, and I went for several weeks in a row. After watching these guys for 2 weeks, I thought, you know, I can be that bad.
And you've been being that bad ever since.
Hopefully I've improved a little bit in the years.
Now, you're now living in Germany. It's a new reincarnation. You are an American comic in Germany. How's that working out for you?
I'm having a ball. I split my time between here and San Francisco, but I spend most of my time in Europe.
Your sort of thing is that you're satirizing international politics and particularly American politics for a European audience.
Well, not so much particularly American. I like to think of myself as an equal opportunity satirizer. I satirize everybody, America, Russia, the Germans, the Italians, the French. There is so much material to work with.
I've been doing a bit of a rooting around, Andy, and we have a clip to prove that everybody is indeed fair game for Andy Valver.
We have an election coming up in America, as you probably have heard about. Iowa, they had the Iowa caucuses last week. You know, letting people from Iowa choose the next president is like letting Walmart dictate the fashions in Paris this fall. I mean, this is an important job, the American president. Americans shouldn't be allowed to choose him.
So that's you satirizing American politics for a European audience, Andy?
Absolutely. That is a European audience. And you'll see, when I said that Americans shouldn't be allowed to vote for the president, the audience applauded because Europeans...
Do they care what's going on in America?
They do care. They're very concerned about who gets elected in America, and they pay attention.
And I guess you have to work a bit harder, do you, sort of setting up punchlines? Because if you're doing American comedy for a European audience, they might not know all the background stuff that Americans would know.
Exactly. You know, I mean, Europeans are quite well read, and it's the same way when I go home to America and I work there. I can't do real specific stuff that Americans just might not know about in Europe.
So you've got it hard. You've got it hard.
I've got the best job in the world.
I thought you might say that. Well, somebody who is doing something rather different to you because he is an American satirist working very much with a domestic audience is comedian Will Durst. Now, you spoke to him earlier, Andy, and I think we found that some people for him are easier to satirize than others.
Hi, Will. So thank you for being on the show.
Oh, for sure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I do a lot of international political stuff, and I know you do some international stuff as well, but you are certainly, as the New York Times says, one of America's best political comedians. So as a political comedian, for you, a Romney win would have been better.
Yes. Our country's gain was my own career loss, but I'm willing to take the bullets. I think it'll be much better for the country. And, you know, the antipathy against him is so strong and it's so vitriolic that there's always room for humor. You could always wedge some humor into that.
Is Obama hard to make fun of?
For a lot of reasons. The racial thing is, it makes it difficult. You got to dance a lively step around that one. And the fact that he's so smooth. Clinton, there was a lot there. They were very fertile. He was a corpulent womanizer. We knew that right away. Bush was pure gold. He was the Full Employment Act for political comedy. And Obama, you know, he's got less friction than rayon pajamas on silk sheets and zero gravities.
Do you think the American political process is just a little bit too long and drawn out?
Well, not for me. I'm a political comic, and I need the audience to know what I'm talking about.
America's place in the world. You travel around the U.S. a lot. What is your sense of how Americans see themselves in the world, or do they even think about it?
No, that's the unfortunate part. I mean, the beauty is that we're so isolated. We have oceans on our east and our west, and our north border, which is a large border, totally consumed with Canada, not the most aggressive nation on the planet, and Mexico to the south. So we're isolated. Where you are now in Bonn, Germany, you know, within 1,500 miles, there's got to be 27 different countries, and not all of them, you know, happy. So it's you can see why people in America, you know, are so self-consumed.
So the new Obama administration, you have a lot of hopes for Obama. I mean, as a political comic, you can only hope for, you know, for Obama to mess up.
Yes, for mess ups and screw ups and decimation and the horrible confrontations.
Well, Will, I want to thank you for your time.
Hey, man, season's greetings to you. And here's to a healthy and wealthy 2013. Hope it's twice as good as 2012.
Andy speaking to the very jovial American satirist Will Durst there, described by the New York Times as possibly the best political comic in the country.
We love to laugh. Loud and long and clear. We love to laugh. So everybody can hear.
Now, humour can be a finely tuned precision instrument, or it can be a blunt object. But if your goal is not so much to provoke laughter as a full-scale political revolution, you probably don't care that much about which brand of humour it is that you're wielding. Political activist art, Andy. Any ideas who I might be talking about here?
A rough guess, I'm going to go with the Russian activist collective Voyna.
They have been making a bit of a name for themselves, haven't you? And you're spot on. They overturn police cars or even set them on fire. They use light beams to project skulls on government buildings. They run over expensive cars with a blue bucket on their head to protest against the use of sirens by state officials on the road. Meet Voyna, a group of very angry Russian youngsters fed up with the rule of President Vladimir Putin and with the traditional ways to protest against the existing political regime. Gert Krut Kurkamp has been following their raucous career with interest.
Outside the Moscow city court, an old woman with a headscarf protests against the punk band Pussy Riot, three members of which are being tried inside for their controversial performance in a Moscow cathedral. The woman holds up a newspaper with a photograph showing members of the Voyna group of artists, which has links to Pussy Riot, engaged in a public orgy. It was one of the most scandalous interventions of the group, which even elicited a response from President Vladimir Putin during an interview on the Russia Today channel.
They organized a group sex session in a public place. That is their right. But when that happens in a public place, the authorities should pay attention. Then they showed it on the internet.
Pussy Riot member Nadezhda Talakonikova, who is now serving a 2-year sentence in a labor camp, was one of the participants in the Weinar Act, which took place in a biological museum in Moscow and was said to be an act of protest against the upcoming presidency of Dmitry Medvedev. During her pre-trial arrest, she was asked by Russian television why she had done this, despite being pregnant at the time.
This is art, political art. My child's life was not in danger. If you read the literature, you'll see that sex is good for pregnant women. It encourages childbirth. Read for yourself.
Political art, that's what the activities of Weinar are all about. The name means war in Russian. Art group Weinar, they call themselves. The group came about in 2007 after a split as the radical wing of a group of street artists in search of new ways to express their anger with the existing political status quo in Russia. Their methods were unconventional and soon attracted attention from the media. They first became widely known after one of their most dramatic acts, which involved drawing a 65-meter-long phallus on a bridge in St. Petersburg, facing the local headquarters of the Secret Service. For that, the group was invited as associate curators at the 2012 Berlin Biennale. But there were other actions as well, such as overturning police cars in Petersburg, which the group said was an anti-corruption protest carried out under the slogan Palace Revolution. Two group members from Petersburg were arrested in the wake of the action on charges of hooliganism. Oleg Vorotnikov and Leonid Nikolaev were later released on bail. They received praise from the famous British street artist Banksy, who promised them financial support. Upon release, Nikolaev said their detention had only increased their determination to continue their struggle.
From above, there will not be any relaxation. If we want to live better and more free, then we must exert pressure. Rock this regime, exert pressure on the authorities. That is the only way.
On a much friendlier note, Weinar members went up to female police officers in the Moscow underground to kiss them. The video of the act on the internet shows, among others, Pussy Riot members Nadezhda Talakonikova and Yekaterina Samutsevich in action. Talakonikova's husband, Pyotr Verzilov, also belongs or belonged to the Weinar group. He has just visited her in the remote labor camp in Mordovia, where she's staying. He's a controversial figure who likes to present himself as Weinar's spokesman, to the dismay of some other members. It's yet another sign of a split in the ranks of the group. Verzilov maintains that a revolution is the only way out of the current situation.
I can only comment on the sentence against Pussy Riot by referring to their latest song, called Putin is Lighting the Fires of the Revolution. My daughter, my wife, and all others will be saved by a revolution. So we will organize it.
Weinar's views may not be shared by the Russian opposition at large and do provoke sometimes heated discussions. But no matter how marginal and controversial they may be, they can no longer be ignored. Not even by their main adversary, President Putin, something this once marginal group must surely regard as a huge success. During a recent meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Putin fulminated against the group and accused them of being anti-Semitic in reply to Merkel's mention of the Pussy Riot affair.
The federal chancellor mentioned the girls who are in a prison for committing a crime in a church. But does she know that before that one of them hanged a puppet of a Jew, saying that Moscow must get rid of these people? You and I cannot support people who spread anti-Semitism. I would like you to keep that in mind. This was a public action in Moscow, in one of the biggest shopping centers.
Putin was correct about the shopping center and the hanging, which did look frighteningly real. But the performance of the Vinyar Group involved real people, not puppets, and they represented guest workers and sexual minorities, and the action itself was a protest against discrimination. It had nothing to do with anti-Semitism whatsoever, suggesting the Russian president was badly informed about the activities of some of his fiercest critics. But being discussed at such high-level talks means that one of the key goals of the Vinyar Group has been reached, to make themselves heard.
Gert Kurt-Horkamp reporting from Moscow on Vinyar, the artist collective, which was the training ground for various members of the now notorious Pussy Riot punk band. That's who you heard in the background there. Back to Germany now, though, because Andy and I have been joined in the studio by Max Stettenbauer. He's 24, he's from Cologne, and allegedly, he's a German comic.
Now, stand-up comedy in Germany becomes very popular. I'm in a movement right now where young Germans, they see American stand-up, they see British stand-up, and they see, wow, we have this great comedic talent in the world, you know, and we still have guys in pink dresses who tell jokes from 30 years ago. So why is that?
Why is that?
Exactly.
Why is that? I think it's just because stand-up comedy is an art form of the people. So the people talk about themselves. You have to talk about your own weaknesses, your own shortcomings. I think that's a big part of my act, you know? But the German people, we talk a lot about our weaknesses. I mean, and the whole world talks about one particular weakness we had in the past. So self-deprecating humor for Germans is still a challenge.
You think that because a lot of comedy revolves around exposing your weaknesses, in Germany there
exactly.
are historical reasons why you might be vulnerable about that.
Exactly, exactly.
So we're bordering on taboo topics here. Let's talk about taboos. Do you consciously go out to make people feel nervous, make people think, oh gosh, he's talking about something I didn't think he was going to talk about there?
I don't try to be shocking to be interesting. You know, I don't try to shock just to get the people to listen to me. I first try to be, interesting and funny. That's my setup, my premise. I think there are more taboos. We live in a society where there is sexual freedom and stuff, and sex is, it's all about sex and stuff. But I think the last taboo in comedy is a man who stands on stage and tries to be honest, just to be honest, and really goes into his fears and his weaknesses. Because there is a comedian, and he knows him, Marc Maron, who talks only about his psychological shortcomings, you know, about his problems he has within his own mind. Something that personal, it's very tough and hard to listen to someone who is funny that way, you know, in a very personal and vulnerable way.
Do you think Germans get nervous when comedians work in that arena? From my experience of living here, Germans tend to be a little bit not withdrawn, but they hold back a little bit. And therefore, talking about real personal stuff is not something that Germans are really comfortable with.
Because it's never done before. You know, nobody in comedy, in German comedy, you are only allowed to talk about the stuff that the audience already knows. But I try to surprise them.
Let me ask you something. We're talking about material and stuff. I've seen you work both in English and in German.
Yeah.
But do you find it, I mean, and your English is really, really good. And I know that you did stand up in the States.
Hang on, Andy, you're being very modest here. I think you played a role in this, did you not?
Well, there's a thing called Comedy Day in San Francisco, which we celebrate every year. And we got Max to come and join us for Comedy
Day. Which
Day.
Was very generous of you.
Well,
but why Max? What made you think, yeah, this guy, I've seen him in Germany. I believe that he can woo an American audience.
Well, you know what? And that was it. I saw him work in English to an expat crowd here in town. And he was funny. He was just plain funny. I mean, that's the bottom line in comedy. You're either funny or you're not. So I talked to Debbie Durst, who is the president of Comedy Day, and I said, you know, there's a kid here. You got to see him. He's funny. She says, all right, bring him out. It's a Comedy Day is a one-day free concert in Golden Gate Park, which we do every year. This is our 32nd year now. Max came out, worked in front of 5,000 people.
And
in the park.
That's the biggest audience you'd had so far, was it, Max?
Or? The first time, yes. But now I had actually a crowd in the middle of this year at the Comedy Festival, which was 7,000. That's what was the biggest right now.
But your first gig of 5,000 people.
Yes.
And it's in a different language.
Yes.
It's a completely unknown. How was that for you?
Well, how was it? You know, if the set I did there at the Comedy Day, I performed this set 40 times. In my head, I performed it 6,000 times. So I think that's the most important factor if you want to do a good performance is to know your stuff inside out. But how was the experience? Well, it was amazing. It was a thrill.
And they laughed.
Yes.
I was there. I watched.
The set at the Comedy Day was great, but there are two things that were more important to me as an artist: met Robin Williams and perform at the Punchline in San Francisco, which is a famous club.
And what did your family back home think of you going off and following in the footsteps of that club?
Well, I've never talked with them about that since then, so I actually stopped talking to them.
How did they react originally to your decision to become a comedian?
Well, my parents are very, very strong people, and the reason for that is that I lost my sister at a car crash when I was 16, and they said, you know, we already lost one child. Before that, they were very rigid. Make good grades. Don't embarrass us, you know? Don't embarrass us.
I know that feeling. My parents said the same thing.
Yes, but after that, it changed their perception. And they said, you know, the only thing we want from our kids now is just to be happy. And if you think this whole comedy thing is your thing, then do it with all your heart and soul.
After the death of your sister, there can't have been much laughter in your household for a while.
No, that's actually, that's a little cynical, but that's actually a great environment for a comedian because there is a lot of pressure. You see all your family depressed because someone you love is taken away from you and you don't know why. And there is will never be an answer to that question, why. And there's like, you know, you want to make them laugh. You want to try to release the pain through laughter, you know. It sounds very corny. But that deepened my relationship to comedy, actually.
What about you personally? I mean, would the death of your sister, the tragedy that your family has been through, would that be something that might pop up in material?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it already happened. But there are things you just don't have the key right now. You know, that's a challenge. That's an artistic challenge as an artist to make the most horrific thing funny. The thing you're trying to do is how deep and how dark you can go, how interesting, how personal you can get and still make it light and still make it funny and still make it interesting.
Sounds almost like a sacrifice.
Exactly. Because if you make fun about, if you talk about stuff like that, very personal, very dark stuff, you distance yourself from it. It's not your life anymore. It's material. It's, all right, where are the beats? Where are the laughs? You know, and you know, I'm in a position right now, I'm a point in my life where something very terrible is happening to me. And I go, this could be a great closer.
Well, stay with us, Max, because we're going to be hearing more from you in the second part of the show. For now, though, you're listening to Worldlink, where I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andy Valver.
Some people call me the space cowboy, yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice, 'cause I'm a picker,
I'm a grinner, I'm a lover, and I'm a sinner. Play my music in the sun. I'm a smoker, I'm a joker, I'm a midnight choker. Get my loving on the run.
You're listening to DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories from behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Andy Valver. In this second half of the show, we'll be spreading the laughter as we go in search of humor in unlikely places.
Yes, chuckles to come will be provided by Indigenous Australian comedians.
And a British yoga class with a difference.
And a Jewish cartoonist in Muslim Turkey.
So the cartoonist is drawing a bomb. He's drawing a bomb. But he draws such a beautiful bomb that the bomb explodes. And the cartoonist's face is full of ink.
First up, though, we're going to continue our interview with German comedian Max Stettenbauer.
Max, I'm curious. German works differently to English, right? So if you say a sentence, then the sentence in German will often have the verb at the end. So that means that you're always waiting to find out what the sentence actually means. How does this affect your ability to be funny?
You know, that's a little bit comedy mechanics a little bit. So the key word of the punchline who releases the laugh actually should be the last. I'm explaining humor to a Brit right now. I'm feeling very proud.
Humility is a great national trait. I hope that
well,
you realize this.
Well, tell me about that.
I would, but I'm too modest.
The German language is tricky. In German we talk differently than we write. So if you want to write German comedy, you will die because the grammar will make it so hard for you to make it as short and as funny and as concise as you want it as a comedian. If you just talk, you know, German don't give a damn about grammar when they're talk. You know, it's like in English, you know, when we talk, we talk differently than we write. And you have to write like you talk as a comedian. And then you can get around that.
There's a lot more young kids that are discovering stand-up comedy. You're having to sort of almost educate your audiences in the art form. And do you find that they're growing, that there's a bigger market for it?
Yes, I think so. By educating them, you don't go upstage and tell them, so little boys and girls, this is stand-up comedy. Right now, every comedian talks about the same things. They talk about IKEA, they talk about Deutsche Bahn, they talk about stuff. And most of the German comedians have a variation of those 5-6 topics. And that's okay. You know, we all share the same reality. The jerk who runs around and complaining about things. That's, I don't like that. I don't like that. What happens with that? That's the archetype of the last generation of German stand-up comedians who complain a lot about stuff.
And it's often a very visual humor if you're watching that generation. So the audience, sort of, they have visual pointers as to when to laugh and how to react. They're very much led through the routine. Now, I've seen clips of you performing. You don't do any of that. Your timing, your delivery is really drawing on an American and Anglophone tradition whereby there are no pointers. Yes.
No, they have to listen. That's just something. I don't say that I do the most intellectual comedy or super messiah George Carlin comedy or something, but the way I do it is just I go up normally. I don't have a costume. I just go up there and talk.
Are there places where you would not go? Are there topics which you would not touch?
If it's just there to hurt someone. That's, I'm not interested in that. I know every joke needs a victim, but there are differences in style, you know, but I'm not here to make jokes about minority or something. That I just think is plain boring. I don't think that's interesting. Or saying dirty words for the shock laugh or something that I'm not interested in. But I think you can talk about everything, even about the very dark topic about the Holocaust. I have a bit about the Holocaust. I think, and the audience reacts very well, because...
both in Germany and internationally.
Exactly, exactly, yes. Because if you take the tragedy seriously, if they feel you're not talking about what actually happened, but the way how we perceive it, I talk about us. I talk about how we perceive it, how we feel about it, and how we not talk about it. We still haven't found a healthy way to talk about this. We still hate ourselves.
Are you faced with people who have a opinion about what you as a German comedian can or cannot say, what topics you can or cannot touch? Do you find that some audience think because you're German, there are some subjects which to you should be taboo?
Yes, there are topics who are absolutely taboo. The most taboo topic is not being funny. That's the only taboo a comedian should have. Not being funny is the greatest taboo. The people have to like you. People have to know you. Funny is everywhere.
Guys, I just want to end with a question for both of you. And I get that we're making people laugh. Why? What's the point of getting people to laugh? Why do you do it?
To do radio shows on Deutsche Welle.
He's smooth.
Oh, he's good. Good.
Do not be deceived by the geeky exterior.
You know what? There is, and I think Max will back me up on this. There is really no other feeling like it on Earth when you can stand on a stage and take a room full of people, and with the little crazy little thoughts that you have in your brain, and make a room full of people laugh over and over and over again. It's one of the greatest highs, and it's almost impossible to describe.
So it's about power.
Well, it's not power. It's addiction. You know, the difference between heroin and stand-up comedy is you can quit heroin.
Well, Max, in that case, I think you have a very long and successful career in front of you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Andy, what is the relationship between a comic and a satirical cartoonist? Is there one?
I think a satirical cartoonist has to work in a smaller, more contained an environment. A lot of times, these political cartoonists are one panel. I mean, and that's really difficult. It's like you have to do the setup and the punchline in one little panel.
You sound really admiring.
It's really, really a tough art form. Yes, I tip my hat to that.
Ah, well, in that case, you may have to be tipping your hat quite a bit, because Ashley Cleek in Istanbul has a portrait of a political cartoonist for whom just about everybody and everything seems to be fair game.
And that's my first cartoon in Sharm newspaper. The first...
Izal Rosenthal's desk is littered with pens. Colored pens, fine-tip pens, feather pens. For years, Izal used to design and make these pens. That was his job. Before he went back to his first love, cartooning.
My name is Izal Rosenthal. I do a lot of things. One of them is cartooning political cartoons for a newspaper called Shalom, which is today the official newspaper of the Jewish community of Turkey.
Izel's trim salt-and-pepper beard is set in contrast with a mane of gray and black hair. He laughs often, and the small lines at the corners of his eyes display both the joy and gravity of humor. In all his 61 years, Izel has not had any formal artistic training. In fact, he says, unlike an artist, a cartoonist cannot be trained.
It's not a real artist, you know. Cartooning is something different. It's something that you have inside yourself. When you are small, young, you start to draw your parents, your little sister or your grandma. It is easier to draw the caricature of older people, you know. And then when you start to school, you start to draw your teachers. And then you see how in trouble you are. Most of them, they don't like it. And when they don't like it, and if you have inside yourself some cartoonist soul, then you feel that you have to draw. You have to draw, and you continue, and then that's how it all begins.
But Ezell's beginning was a bit tricky. He was constantly drawing, but had never published. So one day, he took his cartoons to the offices of Girgir, a famous humor magazine in Turkey, and handed them over to the editor, Oğuz Arel. Arel said he would buy Ezell's cartoons, but there was a catch.
His assistant opened the door, and he gave me back my file. He said, "The master, Oğuz Arel, had chosen two of your works, and you got your money. Go two floor downstairs, they will pay you immediately, but you must have some corrections." I was so happy. Then he closed the door. I opened the file. I saw my two cartoons corrected with a pencil by the master, Mr. Oğuz Arel, saying that, "Look, the guy should look at us, don't make so many lines, you are confusing, etc. But your work is perfect. We bought two of them and you will continue." Again, my anarchist side started to move. And I didn't like it. I didn't like the correction he made. I didn't like what he asked me to do. I didn't collect the money. And I get out. And for a few years, maybe 20 years, I didn't make anything professionally.
But privately, Ezell continued to draw. And a few decades later, after the first Gulf War, the newspaper Shalom decided it needed a political cartoonist, so they called up Ezell. Shalom, as the name hints, is the official newspaper of the Jewish community in Istanbul. The newspaper's offices are on the top floors of an old apartment building. The rooms smell like paper and old books. The Jewish community in Istanbul is small, around 20,000, and aging, but still they publish Shalom weekly. And every week, Ezell's cartoon is on the front page, right-hand corner. Eddie Veron is the vice coordinator for the newspaper.
He's very critical, very, very critical, which we don't want to put in our newspapers. His anarchist sayings about Turkish politics, sometimes it's very straightforward. Then we call him and say, "Yeah, this is very nice, but maybe it will make many speculations from the community. So please change it a little bit." He changes.
It's a difficult time to be a cartoonist in Turkey. Recently, the Turkish government was accused of clamping down on press freedom. According to the U.S.-based NGO, the Committee to Protect Journalists, 50 journalists are currently in jail for what they wrote. That's more than any other country in the world. Ezell says he feels the restrictions. He used to write an op-ed column, but stopped when he realized he was censoring himself. But he continues to draw. For example, Kurdish politics and nationalism is a sensitive topic in Turkey.
Once it was a problem to draw the three colors together, the green, the red, and the yellow, because it represented the Kurdish flag, which is against the whole nation, you know, etc. I drew a cartoon putting the rainbow without those three colors. So now this is okay. So, you see, cartoonists always, they find a solution.
And they should find solutions, Ezell says. But cartoonists must also be aware of what they want to say and how they are saying it. In September, following the riots over the anti-Islam film The Innocence of Muslims, a satirical French weekly published a series of cartoons, some of which depicted Muhammad naked. Ezell responded, in kind, by republishing an old cartoon. The cartoon is six square panels. It starts with a cartoonist drawing a bomb.
So the cartoonist is drawing a bomb. He's drawing a bomb, but he draws such a beautiful bomb, then the bomb explodes. And the cartoonist's face is full of ink. I saw a cartoon of Shabbat saying that the words of Voltaire, I disagree with your opinion, your point of view, but I'm ready to fight for your right of expression.
During the Second Intifada, when violence between Israel and Palestine made headlines, Izal's cartoons were squeezed from three sides: Turkey, the Jewish community in Istanbul, and Israel. So Izal decided to scrap the political caricatures. Instead, he drew fish. Tropical fish. Sometimes swimming alone, sometimes in groups. No one could mistake a fish for a politician. And, Izal points out, fish don't talk. Instead, the minimal words in the cartoons were in the form of thought bubbles. Whenever he is worried that a topic may be too political, too inflammatory, Izal returns to his fish.
That's a cartoonist, you see. There are no taboos for cartoonists. It doesn't exist. They will find a solution. Absolutely. It's like the water, you know. They found a way.
It's meant to be, and I agree. I'm just a redfish in the blue sea. And now I see that it is me. I'm like a redfish in the blue sea.
That portrait of quirky fish Izal Rosenthal was produced by Ashley Cleek. Now, Andy, I want to go back to stand-up comedy for a bit. Talking from your experience of stand-up comedy in the US and in Europe, have you ever felt that certain groups might be underrepresented?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a real shortage of Portuguese comedians.
That's very specific. Talking more generally, though.
Right. There's plenty of them. I mean, some of America's best comics. I mean, Richard Pryor, you know, black comedians, Chris Rock, Richard Pryor, you know, brilliant comics. So I don't know if they're underrepresented. I think, you know, as a comic, I don't tend to see comedy in color. I think humor transcends all colors.
Ah, that's a nice message. And I think it's certainly one which Rachel Bongiorno would agree with. She is from Australia. Now, Australia is a place in which Aboriginal or Indigenous Australian comedians have traditionally been unrepresented on the stand-up circuit. However, Rachel has been speaking to one man who is determined to change all that. Her report begins with the voice of comedian Kevin Cropinieri. However, wait a bit, because the person we're portraying has a more behind-the-scenes role.
Now, I pose this question to you people. Are you laughing with me? Are you laughing at me?
It's a humour that I can absolutely relate to, and most importantly, it makes me really, really proud to see my people up on stage expressing who they are, where they've come from, in a comedy routine, and seeing the audience really respond to it positively. My name is Jason Tamaru. My traditional land is Yorta Yorta country. I'm born in Melbourne. I live in Fairfield.
Growing up in Melbourne, Jason didn't look to the stage or the screen for his comedy relief, disillusioned by the fact that Indigenous comedians were barely existent on the stage, and that in many cases, the comedy that was being performed in mainstream spaces was rife with racism.
I just didn't go to the comedy shows because the comedy that I was hearing was quite offensive to my people, and I don't think anyone would like to go to a show and get offended, so I just didn't go to it. Where I'd go to see the comedy routines for my people would be my backyard or family's backyard or at some type of social gathering, and there's plenty of comedians in those gatherings, so that's where I'd go to get my comedy relief.
As I sit with Jason, having a cup of tea, listening to him lamenting the fact that the comedy industry has been dominated by Anglo-Celtic Australians, he tells me about the time when things started to change for him. He was offered the job of producer of Deadly Funny, an Indigenous comedy competition and workshop series run out of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. It was this that made him realise that comedy is a great platform for Aboriginal people to share their culture and identity with both an Indigenous and non-Indigenous audience, and enable a creative outlet that's also very healing.
Laughter is so healing, you know. It's hard to be stressed out or think of anything when you're giggling your head off. So laughter was an absolute inspiration for me, and I guess it was about time that my people had got given a fair go on the mainstream stage, because we were underrepresented in the comedy world. No qualms about it. There was only a couple of people probably recognised as Aboriginal comedians in this country. And like I said before, you know, we're humorous people and something's not right there. I really wanted to turn the tide the other way.
And I travel all over the country doing comedy these days, and I just got back from Rockhampton. big giant bull. It's a big giant bull because it's the beef capital of Australia, iconic to the region. And I was thinking, you know, then I went to Nambour, big pineapple. Pineapples, iconic to the region. Swan Hill, the big cod. Ballina, the big prawn. I was thinking, what can we supersize in Murray Bridge that represents the region? And I come up with a deadly idea. We could build a big, giant, human neck and paint it red.
As Jason Tamaru explains, pushing social boundaries through comedy has proven to be highly successful. After all, what better way to bring attention to a taboo topic or to challenge a stereotype than by making a joke about it?
It's really, really difficult if you've got some negative views on a particular race of people, in particular my people. It's really, really difficult not to laugh if you hear something really, really funny. Even the most staunchest redneck out there, if they heard a funny joke, they'd have to laugh at it. So comedy is the answer. It's definitely a way to breaking down barriers.
Now, you know what? I recently turned 30, and when you add on the 17-year gap in life expectancy, that makes me middle-aged.
That's Mia Stanford, a Kunkarakan woman from Darwin, and another deadly funny winner. For her and other Indigenous comedians, humour is rooted in storytelling, which has a long tradition in Aboriginal culture.
Storytelling makes who we are as Aboriginal people, and to get a direct answer off us can take a little while because we are storytellers. And we might be new to the comedy arena, but we've been telling our stories for over 60,000 years. So it was a natural fit. When it comes to storytelling, it was really, really easy for us to grasp and turn into a comedy routine.
Thank you, everybody. I'm Mia Stanford.
Comedian Mia Stanford, ending that report by Rachel Bongiorno. What her punchline was, we may never know. But maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe you don't need to have heard something funny to have a good laugh. Contentious, Andy, would you agree? You can just laugh for no reason.
I totally agree. It's laughter is not just about hearing something. I mean, look at Charlie Chaplin. There was never a single word said in his movies, in the early ones, and he was hysterical.
But there's a visual gag, and what I'm thinking of here is a new movement which has swept various countries across the globe. It's called laughter yoga. Have you heard of this?
Vaguely, yes. I have heard of laughter. I'm from San Francisco, so we get a lot of that woo-woo stuff there.
Well, if you haven't heard of it, basically what laughter yoga entails is a series of group exercises which involve no joke telling, no watching of comedy programs, but you have to laugh. And this is all designed to combat anxiety and send people away more able to deal with the stresses of modern life. Andy here is looking very, very sceptical, which indeed was the reaction of Phil Collins when he went to a laughter yoga workshop.
I've spent the past 20 years writing comedy for other people. I've written sketch shows, routines for stand-up comedians, and even shows for children. For me, laughter is all about spontaneity. You laugh because something unexpected happens, and writing comedy is all about fooling people into expecting one thing and then giving them another. I don't think that creating genuine laughter is easy. It requires a lot of technique and hopefully some talent. However, here in Huddersfield, Yorkshire, in Northern England, they're holding a laughter workshop, where I'm told that the people participating are going to find themselves laughing for no reason, without relying on any triggers or, as I call them, jokes.
The theory is that motion creates emotion. So we'll be doing quite a lot of moving around.
The workshops claim to combat stress and promote well-being, and they're run by authorised laughter yoga practitioner Christine Renshaw. Now, I'm very sceptical of the claim that a group of strangers will soon be laughing naturally as a result of a series of staged exercises, or that they'll benefit from it physically or mentally. So, as the attendees arrange themselves into a circle, I ask Christine to give me a bit of background information.
A few years ago, an Indian doctor called Dr. Madan Kataria developed
the brand Laughter Yoga. He started off quite small in a park with a few people, just doing some sort of simple jokes and just doing silly exercises. But after a while, he found that the jokes were running a bit stale and actually it wasn't hitting the button. So he went away and developed all the exercises we now use in Laughter Yoga, and there are no jokes, there's no tickling, it really is just lots of playful activities to stimulate laughter. And every workshop I run, I always start off thinking, oh, I hope it works, and it's never let me down yet.
Okay, so I'm Christy, and I'm a Laughter Yoga leader.
I'm Linda.
I left Christine to get on with it and returned to my observer's chair at the back of the room. Pretty soon everybody's on their feet, and inhibitions certainly need to be left at the door as people are encouraged to laugh like a clown and laugh at a particular body part. It's very hands-on, and everyone seems to be open about the fact that the laughter is forced at the start, and it is, but I'm assured that it's already doing people good. I'm not so sure. If this was a comedy gig, people would be relaxed in the knowledge that someone else was doing all the work. This seems a bit scary to me. People don't know what they're going to be asked to do next. As the group splits into two, each half tasked with laughing to the tune of a famous song, I asked a couple of the attendees why they were here.
I first heard about them after I'd been to a Reiki session with Christine, and she said she thought that laughter therapy would really help me. And so I came along very nervously with a friend to the first session and absolutely loved it. I felt really relaxed afterwards. And actually, I had a very difficult meeting in the afternoon with some decisions that I'd made that I had to deal with. And I'd been very stressed about it. And the laughter yoga really, really relaxed me and actually dealt with the situation without causing any additional stress, which was brilliant.
Woke up feeling not very happy this morning, I have to say. Ended up being a rush to get here on time. Felt a bit kind of twisted and out of shape when we did the first bit of looking at ourselves and seeing how we felt this morning. But I feel a lot better now, taller.
Well, the people here today seem convinced. But is there really any science behind any of this? Earlier, I asked Dr. C.P. Lee, a comedy expert and lecturer in media studies at Salford University.
Physiologists are doing research into the effects of comedy. People who laugh a lot live longer. It does release certain chemicals in the body. It is good for us. Laughter is good for us. Laughter is the best medicine is a phrase that we've often had quoted. But it's certainly true. Oh, it really cheered me up.
OK, so I can accept that laughter makes you feel better. But surely it has to be spontaneous. Today's participants don't seem to think so, though. Over half the class are regulars. So I ask Christine, what makes them keep coming back?
Well, obviously, every time I do a session, I always ask for feedback from people, and people say that they came in feeling very stressed and went out feeling, who cares? you know, feeling that, you know, just sense of just joy and well-being helped them face different problems that they were having in their life. Other people said that they just felt happy. You know, things like that. There's all sorts of feedback from sort of physical symptoms to sort of emotional symptoms to just generally that feel-good factor.
Well, as the session continues, the laughter certainly seems to be more genuine. But then that's what I'd expect. Laughter is infectious. It's the reason why we put laughter tracks on TV comedies. These sessions aren't about the act of laughter itself, though. They're about the health benefits that the physical act of laughter can bring. And after watching a group of people laughing to order, pointing at body parts and flinging their arms in the air for a couple of hours, I can see that they are having a great time. And there is a general feeling of well-being in the room. So, am I convinced? Well, I don't think that comedy writers like me will be out of a job anytime soon. But having said that, I do accept that when people laugh, they do get something physical out of it. After all, that's why people go to comedy clubs. You do feel better after a good laugh. An organised workshop like this isn't for everyone. But then not everyone wants to spend their evenings in a comedy club either. For many people, humour does combat stress. And that's the main thing. So, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to try out some therapy for myself. Who knows, they might even let me sneak a joke in. Excuse me, have you got room for another one?
Laughter
I love to laugh loud and long and clear. I love to laugh. It's getting worse every year.
Phil Collinge, the not-so-sceptical comedy writer, ending that report and indeed ending the show. You're listening to Worldlink, where I am Kate Laycock, and he's...
Andy Valver.
Our studio technician was Jürgen Kuhn. If you'd like to hear any of the items in the programme again, go to dw.de/worldlink or look us up on iTunes. Worldlink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.